First, congratulations on finding the class.
Yeah.
It's a real honor. You have to do a few extra steps to find us up here. But working in the missions world, we're used to kind of going out of the way and getting off in the corner. And I'm glad to have so many of you show up. I'm Dan Buchel. I work with Missions Resource Network. I'm in an administrative role. Phil Jackson here is my co-teacher presenter today, and he directs our Europe work. And Chris Shelby over here is our director for Africa. He's going to be helping me tomorrow with the class, and then we'll all kind of talk on Friday when we have a really cool video professionally produced and a tearjerker that you will certainly not want to miss. Marty Van Roy over here is our tech support. Don't pay attention to her. She's behind the curtain there. She's the Wizard of Oz making everything happen. We actually have very, very little in the way of tech support, but, you know, since she's here, we got to make use of a few slides. MRN is the organization. We work for a Missions Resource Network, and we try to do four things. We talk about mobilizing, equipping, preparing, and caring. And mobilizing is just paying attention to what God's doing in the world and telling people about it and trying to get them to join him. So how do we get together to do what God is doing and to take advantage of the great opportunities that God is presenting us? Equipping is just helping churches to understand their role in the mission of God and do it well. And preparing is training workers, and caring is just making sure that we send healthy people, keep them healthy, and bring them home well. So those are the kind of four things that we do. And Mike Hope's been really gracious to give us a forum every year to just kind of talk about some things that are going on in the world. And so we want to talk with you a little bit today about the historic opening of the Muslim world and what's happening there. But we want to start with the political situation that we're living in today, which is not exactly encouraging on a lot of levels. If you watch the news every night, you see a lot of war and terrorism and refugees and crisis and reactivity and fear. We just got massive issues as the world is shifting around, realigning forces at play that are really disturbing. And because of the radicalism and the warfare and all that's going on with the radicalization of some elements of Islam, and in the post-Arab Spring world, come on in, in the post-Arab Spring world, we're just dealing with forces that are transforming everything. So we are dealing with more migration of people than at any time since World War II. So just to kind of give you some idea of what we're looking at, just in terms of raw numbers, today as we speak, there are about 200 million people who are migrating from one country to another. 200 million people moving who have been displaced in the world today. We have total, I'm told, 720 million people who have resettled outside their home country. And because of ISIS, the radicalization of Islam, wars in North Africa and the Middle East, we are dealing with a historic crisis. So, for example, 12 million Syrians have been displaced from their homes, over half of the population of Syria after 6 years of civil war. 5 million Afghanis have been displaced from their homes because of the ongoing war there with the Taliban. 4 million Iraqis have been displaced. And that's not to mention how many people are taking their lives in their hands just fleeing North Africa trying to get into Europe. So before the most recent crisis, before the Arab Spring, 1,700 people drowned every year just trying to get into Spain for North Africa. That number has just grown exponentially. Landy, do you know how many people drowned last year trying to get into Greece?
Oh.
It's like 3,800 in the fall. I don't know what the final total was, but somewhere around last October, something like 3,800 people had drowned just trying to get into Greece. So people are fleeing because of terror and destabilization, and our politicians and our media are really banking on that. They're using these stories to drive fear. Politicians are using it to topple governments throughout Europe and in the United States. We've seen massive changes politically in response to a lot of what's going on in terms of fear. And a lot of Christians are getting caught up in knee-jerk, reactive, kind of nationalistic thinking that's about protecting ourselves instead of asking, where is God in this? And how do we respond in a Christ-like manner? And so one of the things that we want to do is kind of tell you a little bit about what God is doing in this. We're going to talk a lot about that on Friday, but today and tomorrow, we want to talk about how do we view where God is in the world. What is God doing in the midst of all the suffering and the crisis and the destabilization? We need a scriptural lens to look through to help us have a holy imagination to see where God is at work in this. And we think that the Bible gives us that. We have the resources we need, but we're not taking very good advantage of them. So if you look at the story of Israel, you look at some of the teachings in the Torah and throughout the Old Testament, there are a lot of scriptures that should be instructing how we view what's going on here. So, you know, one scripture, for example, Deuteronomy 10, 18, 19, Moses said, you know, speaking of God, he defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing, and you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt. So there's this constant refrain that this is just one example of that says to Israel, remember, you were refugees, oppressed, vulnerable people. You were rescued. You were migrants. You were brought in, and you were one-time foreigners in your own land. So your story is one of vulnerable, refugee, migrant people. So love other people who have the same story as you. But we have a terrible, terrible time remembering that is our story. Think about that as our story. So today and tomorrow, we want to talk about a couple of Old Testament stories, very vivid stories that kind of help us reframe how we look at refugees and immigrants. Come on in.
Sorry.
The first story, you're going to lose 10 points for showing up late, but anyway. The first story is Ruth, and the second one is Esther. And both of these stories are stories about vulnerable people who are vulnerable in different ways. So Ruth is a story about a refugee trying to survive in a land of her enemies. And Esther is a racial and religious minority in the heart of a violent regime who will kill her if they find out who she is. In Ruth, we see God's faithfulness openly questioned. And in Esther, God is not even mentioned. Both books have women as their central characters, women who have historically been restricted in their access and their ability to lead and their ability to anyway represent God, women who have been historically vulnerable to power and oppression, taken advantage of by the powerful. And yet in both stories, these are the people through whom God works most dramatically to instruct and save his people. Both of these stories, I think, help us develop eyes to see how God works in those places and moments that seem most God-forsaken. If you want to see where God is in what looks like a God-forsaken moment, look at vulnerable women, is what I think these stories say to us. And both of us rebuke the way that we often construct our God stories to protect ourselves from the very people that God is using, that God is speaking to us through. So I want us to kind of reframe the way we look at refugees and immigrants through the eyes of Ruth and Esther. So Ruth, she's a refugee because she married a refugee and ended up a widow and then followed her refugee mother-in-law back home. It starts with Elimelech. Not going to read the story. It's four chapters long. But it starts with a guy named Elimelech, who's a respected father of a family, land-owning citizen. But there's a famine in Israel, and Elimelech and Naomi and his family, they have to sell their land, which means losing their past, losing their identity, losing their status. They lose everything. They sell their land, and they move off to their enemy's land, the Moabites. They leave Bethlehem, which means house of bread, because there is no bread in the house of bread. And they go to Moab, where they are going to be vulnerable refugees. And this is in the time of the judges. And if you've read the Ehud story, you know that the Israelites and the Moabites are sworn enemies to each other. Now think about how desperate you would have to be to sell everything you own and move into a land where you know when you get there you're going to be viewed as an enemy, because that's the only hope you have to survive. It's either that or starve to death. They flee to Moab, trying to avoid death, and when they get there, death is all they find. Mahlon and Chilion, the two sons, they marry Moabite women, which is a horrifying thing in many ways, because in Deuteronomy 23, it says that no descendant of a Moabite shall enter the assembly of God's people for 10 generations. So even if they have kids, they can't ever come home and be part of Israel. But then Elimelech dies, and Mahlon dies, and Chilion dies. They fled death, and they find death everywhere they go. So all you've got is Naomi and these two Moabite daughter-in-laws, or daughters-in-law, and it's just death everywhere they go. And Naomi can't provide for them. She feels obligated to provide for them. And there's no grandchildren. There's nothing. It's just death everywhere. And then word comes that God has blessed Israel again, and there's food, there's bread in the house of bread. And so Naomi says, I'm going home. I'm going home. You stay here. There's no future for you here. And Orpah is the only sensible one in the group who says, you're right. I love you. I want the good for you, but there's no future for me in Israel. I'll be a foreigner. Nobody will want me. I'm better just moving back with my father's family and hope that there'll be some old man that will take me in as part of his harem. But Ruth is the one who does the incredibly stupid thing. She does the illogical thing. She does the foolish thing. She says to Naomi, I'm going with you. And I'm going to go with you if it kills me. She says, you know, I'm going to go where you go. I'm going to live or stay where you stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. And I will die with you, and I will be buried with you. You're going to go back to the bottom of the social heap. You're going to go back as a beggar, and I will go back and be a beggar because I love you, and I'm going to take care of you, and I'll be faithful to you. And the fact that there's no future for you there with me, the fact that you can do nothing for me, is irrelevant. I can't abandon you. And she will not leave this old woman to go back and be alone as a beggar in her own land. Now, that's just crazy. Unless you're operating by a different logic. And she loves this woman. And she's throwing her future away. And she says, I'll go back and just live at the bottom of the heap with you. And so she goes back into a life of shame. And here Naomi goes home. And she gets home. And they say, oh, Naomi, welcome back. And she says, don't call me Naomi. That means pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. Because God has abandoned me. And I used to have a lot of stuff. And now I got nothing. I've come back and God has abandoned me. And turns out she's an evangelist. Because somehow this person who thinks God abandons people has brought back a woman who said, your God will be my God. Naomi comes back with Ruth and says, I came back with nothing. God brought me back with nothing. Except the person who is invisible to her, who happens to be the proof that God is with her. And who gets up every day and goes into the field and begs and gleans from the margins of the field and keeps Naomi alive. Naomi's mad at God and blames God, and Ruth is being the faithfulness of God to Naomi. And Ruth is the Christ figure in the story at the beginning of the story. She is the faithfulness of God to a woman who's bitter at God for abandoning her. She will leave everything for her. Now the question is, will anybody be faithful to this refugee the way that this refugee is being faithful to one of God's people? Is there anybody who will receive the person who's coming in the name of the Lord? Is there anybody here in God's land who's going to receive this person who's demonstrating the faithfulness of God to somebody who says God has abandoned his people? Or are they just going to see her as a threat and a foreigner? Does God have any people who are like this person who's not from the people of God? Ruth does what she can. She gleans. She goes into the fields. And she's vulnerable. She's vulnerable to physical attack. She's vulnerable to sexual attack. And there's no one to protect her. Except there does happen to be a man who has the same kind of honor and character and faithfulness as Ruth, named Boaz. And he goes out of her way. He hears her story. Who is that? Oh, it's Naomi's daughter-in-law from Moab. He hears her story, her faithfulness, and he goes out of his way. And he goes to her and he says, hey, I've heard your story. Don't just glean in the edges. Come into the middle of the field. You come and you eat with my people, and you drink out of the same water jug that they're going to drink out of. You put your Moabite lips on the same cup that the Israelites are going to put their lips on. Oh, and at the end of the day, here's a big extra heaping of grain. Don't you go to anybody else's field, because they might take advantage of you. They might harm you. But I've instructed my men not to lay a hand on you. He goes out of his way to love her and care for her and protect her, because he's as much a man of honor as she is a woman of honor. And she's shocked. Why would you show such kindness to a foreigner? Because that's who he is. And of course, the story goes on, and Naomi is stunned when she hears, and she goes, oh, he's a relative. He has the potential to be a redeemer. And I'm not going to get into all the Levitical laws about all of this, but he's not the nearest relative. But Naomi says, let's make a play for this guy and see if he'll go in the courts and basically take on our family. And it's complicated, because he's not really responsible to marry Ruth, because she's not really the family. And Naomi's too old to have children, so observing the Levirate marriage wouldn't make a lot of sense. But they make a play anyway. And what Naomi asks Ruth to do is scandalous, and it has all kinds of scary sexual overtones, and there's no way to avoid that and be honest with the story. But Boaz is such an honorable man, and Ruth is such an honorable woman, that it comes up with an honorable ending. And he ends up marrying Ruth. But there's this other kinsman redeemer in the story that he has to work with, and he views Ruth the way that everybody else does. He doesn't want to marry her. He doesn't want to take her in. Because if he marries her and she has children, the children are counted as the dead man's children, and they will inherit the land that he would absorb by taking her, and so he puts his own estate at risk. And his motto is, Israel first. Let's make Israel great again. We have to look after ourselves. We start taking these people in, and we put our own at risk. And he passes by. He does not live out the faithfulness of Yahweh in the land of Yahweh. And Boaz says, I'll take her. I'll take her. So he takes Ruth in, redeems her, buys back the land out of his own money. He pays for the land that Elimelech sold. And that land will not go to his heir. It will be counted as Elimelech's heir. So it'll run down a different line, legally. So he's willing to suffer loss and risk to demonstrate faithfulness and to obey the character of God, who came in the form of a refugee. And he says to her, on the threshing floor, at the most vulnerable moment, don't worry, I know you are a woman of honor. You are a woman of honor. The book that's right before Ruth in the canon of the Old Testament, the way that it's arranged, is the book of Proverbs. The last chapter of Proverbs, chapter 31, ends with this question. A woman of honor, who can find? Her price is worth far more than rubies. The next chapter in the Hebrew Bible is Ruth. A woman of honor, who can find? Boaz says, everyone knows you are a woman of honor. And he treats her with honor. So God shows up to his people in the form of a refugee, looking for somebody who will be like God to the refugee. And from this marriage of the faithful Israelite and the refugee is born the child who is the grandfather of the king, the greatest king of Israel, David, and the messianic line runs through that. Now, I think that's kind of cool. I just think that's way cool, because Boaz could see the fingerprints of God in Ruth when Naomi, standing next to her, says, God brought me back with nothing, except who happens to be the source of your own salvation. So here's the question for us. Can we see the Muslim refugee as the possible salvation of Europe and North America? The people who are fleeing death in Syria and Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, in Libya, and on and on and on. And they are fleeing to lands that they think of as Christian lands, where this same God was once worshipped by the masses. But the question is, are there any Boazes who will receive the refugees the way that Boaz received Ruth? Who among us can see Jesus in the refugee who comes in the form of a powerless woman, a helpless and vulnerable person? Who can see the honor and the value of people who are foreigners to us, who we have seen as our enemies? The future of the kingdom of God in Europe is probably arriving on a boat from the Middle East. The Messiah will come back to Europe, probably through a refugee, a vulnerable person. And who is the Boaz who's going to receive him? Who's going to show the same honor? How are we going to relive that story? Because it's the marriage of Boaz and Ruth through which the Messiah and the hope and the promise come. Christianity in Europe's been on decline for a long time. It's pretty nominal, kind of like faith in Israel was at the time of Boaz and Ruth. But the kingdom is being revived as people who come in the name of Allah show up saying, please tell me about Jesus. And it very well could be that God is going to revitalize and reclaim Christendom Europe through a people who have never known his name, who come many times with greater honor and integrity than the people who wear the label of Christian in the countries where they're going. So, we have at least one Boaz in the room, and that's Eleni here, who comes from the Ammonia Church in Athens, where they are welcoming refugees and telling them about Jesus, and we are so grateful. And those of us who work at MRN have signed a partnership agreement to work with them. And we got people coming. We got 16 Europeans who are coming to be trained as missionaries and going to be working there. We got 6 Americans we're bringing. We got over 50 people coming for some type of short-term work. And we're hammering out a partnership. How do we get Americans involved to step into this story so that poor Boaz over here doesn't just get overwhelmed? And so I'm going to toss it now to Phil to step into the story and tell about some modern-day Ruths and Boazes.
In order to provide a little bit more seating space, I guess I'll get up and speak. So,
thanks, but I already brought in another chair.
Yeah. So who's next? No, I think when you share a class, a speaking time, it gets a little clumsy. But I really appreciate, Dan, your opening up Ruth for us. In fact, I almost forgot I was going to speak. I was getting into the story. And I want to offer myself as an observer. I think I'm still being shaped in this. I'm certainly not standing here as any authority in this regard to how we address the refugees, how we view them. I think I am still forming in this because of my exposure has been so limited. Even though that we have made some visits, and those of us that have worked on the field, we've dealt with displaced people. You have in your local churches. I don't think this is an odd situation. You have people move from out of town even. People are constantly relocating. And so it matters how we embrace them, how we treat them. And as we reflect again upon Ruth, I mean, this love for a mother-in-law, I think that's what I'm seeing. I think that's what I can connect to. I think that's what you're connecting to in this Ruth and Naomi relationship is, it's crazy, but love is crazy. And love is wonderful, and love we understand in a sense that we can embrace it, and we're okay with that explanation of love. How am I going to allow this woman who's lost so much, who I am grateful for in my life, how can she journey this alone? And when the other daughter-in-law leaves, I'm sure Ruth saw this as her moment. This honor, this respect, this, I'm not going to let you do this alone. There's God all over that. I don't care if she is a Moabite or a Syrian or an Afghani or a Somali. We know what honor is, and we know what true love is, and we know what commitment is, and when we see it, we know it, and we respect it. I think we respond to it. I think continuing with this and moving our way to Athens, what's it like to be a refugee? I've moved abroad. I sold, and I had it in the bank account. I had a passport that allowed me to travel back and forth as I pleased or needed. I was not a refugee. What's it like to have a life and to literally explode? We've met people who would show us pictures of their houses on their phone. This is where I lived. This is the house now, and it's just rubble. Or a woman, a mother of five that was a Christian, and one day her house exploded, killing her husband and three younger children, her two older daughters being taken by a mother-in-law to Sweden. Their strange relationship not enabling her even to talk to her remaining children. How do you relate to that? What's it like to be a refugee? What's it like to have loss? I would think that when you're on this journey moving, you're really depending on someone to receive. It's a hope. And I would think that it's a great fear, but there's a hope that there'll be someone or something, some government, some door that I can walk through. I'm not speaking to this audience because I think we're on the same page with this. I think these are people of grace and love and peace and sensitivity. But we have to admit in this world, and often even among our brothers and sisters, generosity is kind of based on a mood. It's a hobby. Generosity is typically exercised when you can afford it. It's not a formed character, an aspect of our identity always. And I think when we run across people like Eleni who saw and responded, not out of her wealth, but she had no choice to. It was in her. And the other Boazes that we know we've been interacting with. But Naomi found Boaz. And I say Naomi. We know that Ruth has this pivotal element in the story, but it's Naomi who's estranged from her people, her family, her land, her lineage. She's the one. And her husband's name. They are the ones that are being erased from the family record. And so Naomi finds Boaz. And this idea that Boaz restores Naomi and her name and her husband's name, her son's name, to the lineage of her people. This is significant. And I think that's why I would like for us to consider, and this is where I'm trying to form. I want my reaction, my activity, my mission, my role, my small role in the mission of God, not to just be charity. It's not charity that we do. And it's not charity, Eleni, that you're exercising. What you're doing is you're revealing the true identity of the people. Naomi was not a nobody. Now, she may have had nothing, but she's not a nobody. She's not an insignificant. She's a Jewish person. She's a member of Israel, people of God. That's not nothing. And because she's in this season of loss, that does not reduce who she truly is. And just because Saeed from Baghdad, and Wissam, and Tariq and Linda from Syria, just because when we happen to see them, they have nothing. But whatever flip-flops and t-shirts they get from the bin over here. We don't view them. You haven't viewed them as nobodies, beggars. That's not who they are. They're people. They have an identity. Before God, they haven't did it. And what Boaz does is not out of charity, but it's like pulling away a veil. This is who Naomi truly is among our people. And her name and her family's name will continue to the point where the greatest king of all time, two generations later, will be born. What an honor for Naomi and Boaz. And here again, Boaz is not exercising charity. He's fulfilling a role that allows he himself to be realized in his true identity. Because who is Boaz without Ruth? Would we even know him? He's not in the lineage. He's not in the genealogy without Ruth. So even Boaz fulfilling his role in enabling Naomi to re-identify in her identity realizes his identity. And I think this is something that I'm chewing on. In this moment, we do not respond to what we see, to what we know, because it's a good thing to do. We do so because it reveals who we are. It allows us to be part of the story. It allows us to step into the lineage of God. I look like a pretty nice guy, but in a former life I was a pawnbroker. I've had some interesting jobs, and I think the pawn industry, being a pawnbroker, was probably about the most fun job I've ever had in my life. I loved it. One of the reasons is just the interaction of people. And I was a pawnbroker in Dallas. About 60% of the population of Dallas does not have a bank account. They don't live on the fat of their savings. They live basically week to week, month to month, paycheck to paycheck, and many, many times the paycheck won't make it to the end of the month. So what do you have? You take what you do have, what is yours, what is your possession, and you go and you get enough that you can make it to the end of the month. And I would watch people come and go, and we would have pretty regular customers in the shop. And to be quite honest, I mean, all pawnbrokers aren't evil, terrible people. I'm here to testify. Some of my best friends are pawnbrokers. In fact, a third of my support when I was on the field was provided by a pawnbroker. He's the only guy that ever gave me a raise. Not even my church gave me a raise. But my pawnbroker friend gave me a raise. I remember people coming in, and it was when they would pawn their, get a loan on a ring or something. They weren't giving me the ring. It was their ring. They were borrowing some money until they could come back, and with the interest, of course, get their ring back. But when they would come back and they would redeem their ring, now, they didn't buy their ring. It wasn't my ring. They rediscovered, reestablished, affirmed their ownership and possession of what was already theirs. And when I'm reflecting on what's happening here, Eleni, I'll talk to you. Because Eleni right now is our celebrity. She's the one that really should be teaching this, and she has a class later that we all are going to go to in mass. But what Eleni and Alex and the church in Athens, the Ammonian Church of Christ, what they're doing is they're inviting these refugees in, these people in. And they're not establishing what they are. They're reminding them. They're affirming them. Who they are and who they can be. You're not making it. The Lord Jesus is going to fully redeem them. But what you're doing is you're reaffirming, you're re-identifying, redeclaring what already is. These are God's children. These are people created by the Father. who deeply, deeply cares for them. And I agree. I think what has been said on different occasions, that God is seeking out a people because of the many, many stories that we've been hearing. God is becoming personally involved into the redeeming of these people. There's a nuance here that I think is very important, and I'm still struggling to understand it. But redemption, what Boaz did, he didn't make Naomi a member of Israel. She already was. He didn't make her a person of great value and love. She already was. Everything that Naomi ultimately became, she already was. Boaz revealed it. And I'm wondering if this is our moment as God's people, as disciples of Jesus, as Christians. Our engagement with these refugees is not to make them something, but to reveal who they are. God's people. Now, I understand the redemption of Jesus Christ. I understand the story. But I'm trying to understand what my role is in it, so that God can truly bless these people. I'm praying for the opportunity also to be part of this story, to be part of this lineage, to be part of what my grandchildren will talk about. And as we move into Europe, I don't know if I can bite that part of the sandwich off right now, the whole redemption of Europe. I think it will happen. I'm hoping it will happen. I'm curious to see how it will happen in small and grand ways. I think we're going to get there. But I think for today, I'm trying to understand better. I'm trying for us all maybe to encourage one another, discuss among ourselves truly what this moment could truly mean. An opportunity to work with God in revealing who these people are. And an opportunity, like Boaz, to actually step into the story and step into the lineage of a great kingdom that includes Moabites and Syrians and Iraqis. I find it interesting now that Eleni will tell you these things, as Eleni has been working over the last several months with families, how many Eleni babies have been born? I think there's about four, three or four, just two. Mackerel. But people are starting to name their children after the Boaz that received them. They're starting to add Eleni's name to their family lineage. And I think this is a blessing of God and His people, and God's people functioning in their proper role. As Dan said, there's a lot of work to do. There are a lot of things that we want to do. But I think more than anything, right now, we're trying to do is mobilize prayer. If you are not currently praying daily for the situation in the Medrim, for those that are in camps, for those that are displaced, for those that are on the move, many in the Middle East, many still in Turkey and in Europe, those that are being relocated, those that are having to learn new languages, their children are having to go to different schools, having to decipher and to figure out how they're going to live this new life, please join this prayer. Chris is passing out a card that's is our website that's connected to the MRN website, that you can go to the MedRim page, sign up, and you'll be receiving weekly emails of encouragement, of information. I know it's helpful sometimes to just have some prompts in prayer, but also just information that'll help you kind of satisfy some curiosity and need for information.
And one thing about getting that kind of stuff, we can forward it on.
We're trying to get 10,000. We believe in order for a people movement, a disciple-making movement to actually take place, prior to that, a prayer movement is most necessary. If we're committed to prayer, we're committed to our role as priests, advocating on behalf of these people, and certainly advocating and asking God for helping us to realize our role physically. I know many of you are already involved in this, and we thank you so much for that. But please sign up. That helps us kind of to know that we're doing what we can to mobilize prayer. If you don't sign up, that's, I guess, you know, nobody's going to come knock on the door or anything. But signing up does allow us to see, you know, are we doing what we need to do just to get the word out and to help people participate. Just want to say thank you so much for attending this class. And before we end it, I do want to make sure that we have a prayer blessing for what the Ammonian Church of Christ is doing.
So on Friday, this goes through Friday, right? I never can tell what day we're going to do. Let me tell you. On Friday, we're going to give you kind of an overview with a lot of statistics and data about what God's doing in the Muslim world. You know, just a couple of tidbits. More Muslims have come to Christ in the last 20 years than in the 1,400 years of Islam preceding combined, according to the Crescent Project, who also says that the Muslims that they have had contact with who come to Europe, 4 out of 7 of them come having had visions and dreams of Jesus on the way. Now, if you have no place in your theology for God who actively works in the world today, don't engage the Muslim world. Because they're going to just shoot right past you into stuff that you're not going to be able to understand. And we don't have a great understanding. But God is doing something historic. We've been back on our survey trip back in the fall. We've been back a couple weeks, and a lady called me. She's like, we baptized 25 Afghanis. We don't speak Dari. We need some help. We can't disciple these people. Like, we're working on it. But there she is, every Tuesday and Thursday, feeding these people. 120, 140 coming, wanting to hear about Jesus, seeing him in their dream. So, Eleni, we want to have you come up. You need to go to her class. You need to hear her stories. But she is Mama Teresa to a lot of people. She is. And so,
no,
yes, ma'am.
Far better, she's Mama Eleni.
Mama Eleni.
Could
wow.
I just mention one way that people in Europe are probably not going to be able to go where they are? Can really get involved in doing things. I attend a church in Long Beach, California, and we started several years ago a Friends Speak program, which is an offshoot of Let's Start Talking. In fact, we've got something at the field house. And I am currently studying, becoming a friend with, along with two women from Syria. The husband of one of them meets with my husband regularly, and a Palestinian. And they are opening my eyes tremendously to the scriptures because they are coming with knowledge of the area where it all started that I don't have, and just opening, I mean, they're just such good friends of mine now. And all we did was hang out a banner on a main street near our church that says free English practice, because that's what we're doing. It's not a bait and switch. We're offering them English so they have a voice. They need to learn the language if they're going to live here. But they fall in love with Jesus. And it's just the most wonderful thing to watch that happen as we simply read a very simplified version of Luke. We tell them that's what they're doing when they come in the door, well, before they come in the door, that they were going to be using the Bible. But to watch what's happening, and many of them we are finding are very disillusioned with Islam, and they are looking for something else. And that is something that people here in this country who may never go to Europe or other places where they're coming in masses can be doing. Just making yourself available one-on-one.
They're already around you. And LST has a wonderful ministry that they've been doing around the world for years. But the French Speak program you can do in your church with immigrants who desperately need to improve their English. It's a wonderful program. Love LST. The president of LST and I meet for breakfast every Wednesday. We're both in town, and they're involved with us, and we really encourage you to utilize that because it's already prepared. There's a curriculum. It's so easy. It's just making yourself available. So these people are already in your world. Eleni, if you would come up, we just want to say a prayer blessing over you, and we're so thankful for the work that she's doing in Athens. You can do this, maybe not on the same scale, they may not be coming to your community by the thousands and overwhelming you, but they are in your community. Eleni, when's your class?
Tomorrow at 3:30.
Where is it?
What is it?
AC
286.
286. So just down a little ways, 286. AC. And you're going to want to hear her stories. You know, I was, when you were talking, I was thinking about Saeed, who is was an attorney with a practice in international business law from a Middle Eastern country before a mortar shell hit his house. And when we were there, he was not yet a follower of Jesus, but he was fascinated with Jesus. And he was so done with Muhammad and war and conflict. And then you call me, I don't know, we'd been back a week or two, and like, Saeed confessed Christ and he's going to be baptized. I said, I love Jesus. My wife loves Jesus. Our daughter loves Jesus. I want to go to Germany and plant a church. I want to go back to my home country and plant a church. This is the unintended consequence of radical Islam and terrorism and the warfare. The people who are trying to drive people with warfare to Muhammad are actually pushing them to Jesus. God's at work. When you watch the news and you see the bad stuff, God is triumphing over that. Phil, would you lead a prayer of blessing over Elaine?
Good and Holy Father, we come before you as your people. Father, you're so gracious to call us your children and to not only create us to be, but to redeem us to be. I'm so grateful, Father, for your goodness and your grace and your, the way that you form and fulfill your will in this world. And so many things we do not understand. Never understand, but we do realize, Father, that you are constantly close, you're constantly working, and that you can make things good, and you do make things good. Even in the suffering that we see, Father, our hearts break. There's a part of us that refuses to understand why. Why do people have to suffer so? I like it. But we rejoice, Father, as your goodness emerges, triumphant over it. And not in small ways, but in mighty ways, such as the Ammonia Church in Athens, where Alex and Eleni have stood up and said, come here, be with us. We will love you, we will listen to you, we will remind you who you are. People of honor, people dearly loved. And so, Father, we proclaim your goodness as we recognize our sister, Eleni, who represents the many Boazes that are reaching out to many people today. We declare your goodness, and we testify to it, Father. May we be stubborn in our faith and dependency on you. May we walk in faith in ways that may be confusing and just crazy in the world, but because of your great love, for your great purpose that we trust in, may we continue to walk forward into it. Thank you for this group. I ask your blessings upon this group. I think this group represents a great heart to serve and to love and to be Boazes in their local community and abroad. Bless each one here. I offer this all, Father, in the name of Jesus, your Son.
Join us for lunch tomorrow at the Han Fireside Room for an MRN lunch. Tomorrow in here, same time, we'll be talking about using Esther as a lens to look at Christians in North Africa. And then on Friday, we'll talk more about the opening up of the Muslim world.
So will there be opportunity for questions?
Yeah, we will. We'll try to. We ran a little long. So.